That will be a great day for those who are ready to see God. You see, it's possible to have peace and hope in the midst of a world filled with turmoil.
Michael, you keep talking about the judgment of God. You talked about it when we were on Ararat looking for Noah's Ark. You said that the worldwide flood was God's judgment against the wickedness of man. And you've talked about God judging Belshazzar for his evil with the handwriting on the wall. That's pretty scary stuff.
Yes, it is, Isis. You see, most people think that war is terrible. They think that terrorist bombings are hideous, and they are. War can cause shortages of food in a country, which creates widespread famine. Most developing nations barely have enough food for their people. It is estimated that 500 million people on Earth are seriously malnourished. Famine can also be caused by cyclones, floods, droughts, pests, plant disease, or even tsunamis. We saw this in the Indian Ocean earthquake that created a 100-foot tidal wave. The findings suggest that it was an earthquake of a 9.3 magnitude.
It was terrible. I had to stop watching the news for weeks afterward, Isis put in. It was too emotionally draining. I heard the estimates for loss of life could reach 310,000 people.
That's true. Earthquakes have killed a lot of people. The earthquake in Syria in AD 1201 claimed the lives of more than 1 million people. The one in Haoxian, China in 1556 killed 850,000. The Great Chilean earthquake was a 9.5 quake. In fact, the top 25 earthquakes have killed more than 6 million people over the years. Scientists tell us that 81% of the world's earthquakes take place in what is called the Ring of Fire tectonic plate.
Why are you telling me all of this? Isis asked.
I'll explain in a moment. Let me just mention one more thing. The Bible talks about wars and rumors of wars, famine and earthquakes. It also talks about pestilences. That doesn't refer to just crop damage. It includes all kinds of diseases. What do you think is the biggest and most devastating disease today?
HIV/AIDS.
Right, it's killed millions, especially in Africa. In Malawi, it's estimated that almost 20% of the population is afflicted with HIV/AIDS. But have you heard about the new super strain of AIDS called 3-DCR-HIV? It was found recently in a 40-year-old man who was a drug user and had hundreds of partners in the past several months. This particular strain has never been seen before. It's unimaginably aggressive and resistant to almost all treatments. 19 of the 20 drugs in use today are ineffective against it. But here's the real kicker. In the past, most HIV infections didn't turn into AIDS until 9 or 10 years later. This new virulent strain moves at lightning speed. From the onset of the HIV infection, it only takes 2 to 3 months to develop into a full-blown AIDS case. Another man in San Diego has been diagnosed with this new strain. The news is causing a panic in the gay community.
I can see why.
You asked me what was the point of all of this. All of these things are terrible. They unnecessarily destroy human life, and they are of great concern. The question is, if we are overwhelmed by these tragedies, shouldn't we be even more concerned with sin, which destroys the human soul and separates us from a holy God? Jesus stated it this way in Matthew chapter 10. And do not fear those who kill the body but cannot kill the soul, but rather fear him who is able to destroy both soul and body in hell.
I need to think that through, Michael, Isis murmured. As you know, I don't have a Christian background. All this is new to me.
Murphy nodded. He was falling in love with Isis, and she had not yet come to the point of faith in her life. He did not want to lose her or have her meet God without settling the issue of receiving Christ into her life. Isis closed her eyes and laid her head on Murphy's shoulder. She felt safe, comfortable, and protected next to him. She had never met anyone quite like him.
What if all he was saying about the end times were true? What if the judgment of God is a reality? I don't think I'm ready for that.
As Isis tried to sleep, Murphy closed his eyes and began to pray. Murphy was starting to drift off when he heard Bingman speak.
Michael, have you been to Baghdad before?
On one other occasion, Murphy said, shaking himself awake.
What's it like?
Well, it is a large city of about 5 to 6 million people. It's the transportation hub for Iraq. It is probably the richest and most economically solid city there. It is the headquarters for the Central Bank of Iraq and the center of financial operations for the country.
Will it be dangerous for us?
It could be, but we'll be escorted by the military, which will provide protection. My experience from Desert Shield is that they'll also provide a target for the enemy to shoot at, Bingman said. That could happen, too. However, I don't think that the military will be taking us into the more dangerous sections of the city. One of the things you'll notice is the wide streets. They make moving around the city easier.
What did you think of all the National Guard at Dulles?
Bingman changed the subject. They did look impressive.
Yes, I think the president has the right idea in calling in the Guard and closing all the borders into the United States. However, I think he should have done it earlier. It's sort of like closing the barn door after the cows are already out.
I think we'll see that his decision is not temporary, Will. Closed borders may very well become part of our national policy in the future. People may demand protection, and the politicians will have to respond.
To be honest with you, Michael, I think I'd prefer a closed border to having to watch out for terrorists all the time. Does that sound awful?
No, a closed border can give better control and a feeling of security. There's nothing wrong with that.
It won't make us the most popular country by other nations if we do make it more difficult for people to visit, Bingman said pensively.
Well, a lot of them haven't liked us when we've had an open-door policy, Murphy replied. They like our money and our freedom and want to live here, yet they hate us at the same time. It is a strange situation.
I know what you mean. If I were to move to another country, like, say, Romania, I could become a citizen, but I would never be a Romanian. But when people come from other countries to the U.S. and become citizens, they become Americans. America is made up of people from hundreds of countries who have blended together. It has truly become the land of the free and those who seek freedom. That's what our Statue of Liberty is all about. It sure makes me feel proud to be an American.
You're right, Will. It's the blending together of cultures as one nation that has made us strong. One of the things that will destroy America the fastest is when people from other countries come here and attempt to recreate their own country on American soil. That type of multiculturalism will cause division. President Theodore Roosevelt had strong convictions about that when he said, "There is no room in this country for hyphenated Americans. The one absolutely certain way of bringing this nation to ruin, of preventing all possibility of continuing to be a nation at all, would be to permit it to become a tangle of squabbling nationalities."
Cultural division does increase tension, Bingman agreed. Just look at where we're going. Look at the infighting and vying for control in Iraq. There's so much tension among the Kurds, the Sunni, and the Shi'i. If democracy is going to work there, they'll have to begin to think of themselves as one nation rather than three cultures fighting for power. Do you think moving the United Nations headquarters to Babylon would help to unite them?
It probably will in the short run, but in the long run I think it's part of a move for a one-world government to be led by the Antichrist. The world will be looking for a leader who will promise to lead countries away from war and terrorism. Words of peace will sound very attractive. If you put that together with the hope of eliminating famine, decreasing poverty, protecting the environment, reducing corruption, and instilling universal spiritual harmony among people, he could win the world with that message.
You're probably right, Michael. I wonder how we fit into the picture.
I think our role is to try to sound a warning about future judgment and share the good news that God has provided a solution to the problems of the world through Jesus. He is the only one who can lead us to peace with God and harmony with our fellow man, not the Antichrist. We live in exciting days, Will, and I think they're going to get even more exciting as we draw closer to his return.
There was silence for a while as both men thought about their own roles and responsibilities. Finally, Murphy broke the silence.
Well, tell me a little about yourself. Do you have children?
Yes, I have three. Two daughters and a son. Amber, my oldest, is a senior in college. She's studying to be an English teacher. Amy is a sophomore and is planning to go into psychology. Adam is in his senior year of high school. I don't think he has any idea of what he would like to do other than play football. But when I look back at my own life, I didn't know what I wanted to do either when I graduated from high school.
It sounds like you have a wonderful family. Do you have any pictures?
This is Arlene, my wife, Bingman said, smiling and offering Murphy pictures from his wallet.
It sounds like and looks like God has blessed you, Murphy said, examining the pictures.
Yes. When all is said and done, it's your relationship with God and your family that really matters. I don't like to be away from them, but my wife knows how much I like adventure. This is a trip of a lifetime, Bingman exclaimed.
Well, I think we might have some excitement waiting for us in Baghdad. It might be good for us to get as much rest as we can, Murphy said.
Bingman nodded and closed his eyes. Murphy closed his eyes, but sleep did not come easily. He was filled with a growing sense of apprehension. Chapter 53. The sound of the captain speaking over the loudspeaker woke Isis. She looked over at Murphy, who was reading his Bible. He glanced at her and smiled.
Looks like you got some sleep.
I did, but I still feel tired.
Sitting up isn't the most restful sleep position, Murphy agreed.
Isis thought that it didn't really matter how tired she was because she was with Michael. And it would be for a couple of weeks. Just being close to him made her heart beat fast.
I wonder if there's any hope that he's feeling the same way.
As the plane touched down and began to taxi, Isis was jarred back to reality. Out the window, she could see U.S. Air Force jets, helicopters, and military vehicles everywhere. Murphy, Isis, and Bingman were all surprised at how many people were flying in and out of the Baghdad airport.
Well, said Bingman, I don't know what I expected, but this is a busy place. It's as packed as any airport in the U.S.
Except there are a lot more military on security watch, Isis replied. It makes me feel insecure rather than safe. Weird, huh?
The words were just out of her mouth when a tall U.S. Marine captain approached. He was dressed in crisp desert fatigues and boots, wearing two shoulder holsters. He was flanked by two younger soldiers carrying rifles.
Are you Dr. Murphy?
Yes, and this is Dr. Isis McDonald and Dr. Wilfred Bingman.
The captain shook hands with everyone.
I'm Captain Michael Drake, and I serve under Colonel Davis, who is stationed in Babylon. He asked me to escort you. I'll assist you through customs, and we can then pick up your luggage. Hopefully it will be a little faster with my help. We have hotel rooms reserved for you in the Green Zone. It's safe and well protected. Most of the news reporters and other dignitaries stay there. We won't be leaving for Babylon for a couple of days. We'll be joining a convoy going that direction. It will be safer that way.
Captain Drake, we were supposed to meet an Egyptian friend in Baghdad, Jassim Amram. He's supposed to travel with us to Babylon. Will he be able to enter the Green Zone? Murphy asked. Otherwise, I can meet him outside.
I'm afraid not, sir. We've recently had a rash of bombings and security has tightened down. If he's going to travel with us, we'll have to meet him just outside of the zone. Regarding leaving the Green Zone, you will be permitted in and out, but once you leave, you'll no longer be under U.S. military protection. Americans do stand out in a crowd, and in some parts of Baghdad, it would be extremely dangerous for you to travel alone.
I appreciate that word of advice. We'll keep it in mind.
Murphy, Isis, and Bingman were standing just outside of the Green Zone checkpoint as the sun was going down. It had been a very warm day, and they had been able to swim and relax after the long flight of the day before. It wasn't long before an older Mercedes drove up, and out stepped Jassim Amram.
Michael, it is so good to see you.
Amram was wearing his usual white suit, which hung loosely on his gangly frame. His rich, mellifluous laugh rang out as he gave Murphy a big hug. He then turned toward Isis and smiled.
And the lovely Dr. MacDonald.
Amram took her hand and gently kissed it. Bingman held out his hand.
I'm Wilfred Bingman. Nice to meet you.
Well, come, come. Let's not stand here. I have a good restaurant selected for tonight, and we can discuss this new adventure.
Jassim, are you sure that it is all right for us to move away from the Green Zone? You know, we'll stick out like sore thumbs, especially Isis with her red hair, Murphy asked, worried.
Amram waved his hand.
Michael, there is no problem. The area that we are going to go to is very safe, and the food is excellent.
The men were deep in discussion about the handwriting on the wall when Isis began to look around the restaurant. She had felt uncomfortable for most of the evening. She knew that many of the men in the restaurant were looking at her. Although she had draped a scarf over her hair and was wearing long sleeves, she still stood out. The few other women there were looking at her and making comments. The experience was a little unnerving.
I just need to relax, she told herself firmly. Jassim said it was safe.
As she glanced around the room, she caught the eyes of an Arab eating by himself nearby. He immediately glanced away. As he turned, she thought she saw something on his neck.
A tattoo?
Could it be?
He's got the tattoo of an upside-down crescent on his neck with a star below it.
Isis reached out and grasped Murphy's hand under the table. He could tell something was wrong by her firm grip. He turned and looked at Isis while Bingman and Amram continued their conversation. Isis was looking in the direction of the man who was standing and leaving his table, and she looked frightened.
She leaned over and whispered, "Did you see his tattoo? It was an upside-down crescent with a star under it on the side of his neck."
"Are you sure? How did one of Talon's men find us here?" Murphy exclaimed.
"Well, it is getting late," Amram was saying. "I should get you back to the Green Zone. The military get very suspicious and have a hair trigger on anyone who approaches the zone after 10 p.m.
Amram brought up the handwriting on the wall as they left the restaurant. Deep in discussion, they didn't notice a dark vehicle approaching slowly. At the first sound of gunfire, Murphy reached out, pushed Isis to the ground, and covered her with his body. Amram and Bingman also hit the ground, as bullets sprayed a brick wall and shattered the restaurant window. Then Murphy jumped to his feet, pulling Isis with him.
"Run!" he shouted, heading for a dark alley next to the restaurant, dragging Isis along with him.
Amram and Bingman were also up and running.
"Good. None of us has been hit."
Murphy could hear the screech of brakes behind him. Whoever had shot at them had stopped and was backing up. As he ran down the alley, Murphy noticed an opening into a courtyard to his left. It was too narrow for a car to follow. The attackers would have to pursue on foot. Murphy turned into the opening, motioning for the others to follow, then ran across a courtyard into another alley. They began to zigzag through alleys and yards in an attempt to escape. Soon they came to a small street on which there were a number of shops and restaurants.
"Over there!" Amram shouted.
They crossed the street and entered a small restaurant, breathing hard. Every head turned their way as they entered. The group tried to walk nonchalantly to a table at the back, but it was obvious that they were out of place. Pairs of dark eyes followed them, focused on the three white faces. Americans never frequented this local hangout, especially a light-skinned woman with flaming red hair. Everyone knew that they were in trouble. Was there anyone in the room they could trust? Murphy, Isis, Bingman, and Amram looked up at the faces that were staring at them. Eventually, a short, stocky man approached and said something to Amram in Arabic.
"The man says that we should follow him," Amram translated.
The stocky man led them through the kitchen, opened a door that led to the alley, and pointed. Obviously, the man was giving them an escape route out the back. Maybe the people in the restaurant wouldn't say anything to those pursuing them. It was worth a chance. The group walked quickly through several more alleys until they found a place to rest.
I am so sorry for what has happened, Amram cried. I can't understand how we were targeted. I will work my way back to the car and come pick you up. Remain here. I will return as soon as I can.
Be careful, Jassim. Those men are out there somewhere. We'll keep in the shadows until you return, Murphy replied.
After 10 minutes, Murphy, Isis, and Bingman heard the sound of people coming up the alley. They froze and waited in the shadows of a doorway. Isis, trembling, grabbed Murphy's arm and stood close to him. 4 men approached, slowed, and finally stopped right in front of the doorway where the Americans were hiding. Then one of the men lit a cigarette. In the flickering light, Murphy could see that one of the men carried an automatic weapon, 2 had knives, and the 4th had some sort of club. But the light also enabled the Arabs to see them. The one with the gun yelled and motioned for them to come out of the doorway. Murphy, Isis, and Bingman stepped forward. The 4 Arabs began to argue in Arabic. Quietly, Isis began to interpret.
The large one with the knife says that they should kill us right here. The one with the gun is saying no. He thinks we should be taken to their leader for him to decide. The heavy one with the other knife says that they should behead us right now. The small one is arguing that they should have fun with me before they kill me.
Murphy looked at Bingman. Their eyes briefly met, and Bingman gave a slight nod. Murphy knew it was best to move while the Arabs were arguing. He went for the man with the automatic weapon. As he stepped forward, the man started to bring his gun up. Murphy's left hand hit the weapon as it started to fire, deflecting the bullet. Murphy spun around in one spot, raising his right elbow and driving it into the gunman's right temple. He was instantly down and out. Bingman took on the big man with the knife, who lunged straight forward. Bingman sidestepped, pulled off his jacket, and rolled it over his left arm as protection. The Arab lunged a second time, this time trying to stab Bingman in the face. Bingman blocked the knife with his jacket-covered arm. He drove his right fist in an uppercut motion into the Arab's diaphragm. Then Bingman brought his knee up, breaking the man's nose and shattering his cheekbone. He was through. Isis decided to take on the small man with the club, the one who wanted to have fun with her. As she started to charge him, he raised the club over his head and shouted, "White whore!" Suddenly, she dropped down as if she were sliding into home base, raised her left foot, and drove it straight into his groin. The man dropped the club, rolling on the ground and wailing in pain. Isis picked up the club and was about to hit the Arab when Bingman grabbed her arm.
"Allow me," he said, driving his fist into the man's face.
In the meantime, Murphy had taken on the tall Arab with a knife. Murphy dropped down and did a leg sweep, knocking the man's feet out from under him. He then jumped up and drove his heel down on the man's hand that was holding the knife. The Arab screamed as his fingers broke. Then Murphy grabbed the knife, dropped to one knee, and placed the point on the tall man's throat. He could see an upside-down crescent tattoo on the Arab's neck.
"Who sent you after us? Who are you working for?" Murphy cried.
Isis translated. The man only moaned and clutched his broken fingers. Isis repeated the question as Murphy pushed on the knife, breaking the man's skin and drawing a bead of blood. Finally, the Arab spoke.
"The man with the razor finger wants you dead," Isis translated. "He says the people he works for need you eliminated."
"What do you mean, the people he works for?" Murphy asked,
pressing his knee into the Arab's belly. Again, Isis translated what was said.
"The 7.
"The who? Who are the 7? Murphy asked.
As soon as Isis translated that, a look of absolute terror came over the tall man's face. Murphy knew that the man would die before he would reveal that secret. He tossed the knife away and drove a reverse punch into the man's chest, rendering him unconscious. Bingman picked up the weapons, took out the automatic's bullet clip, and tossed everything over a wall. Then he threw the bullet clip as far as he could in the other direction. Murphy ran to Isis, who was wild-eyed and breathing hard. Yet she did not look afraid. She looked like a wild tiger waiting for her next victim. He pulled her in his arms.
Are you okay?
I am now, she whispered, hugging him tight. Murphy was trying to process what had been said.
The man with the razor finger, obviously Talon, works for a group of people called the Seven, and they want me dead. Why?
As Jassim Amram drove up, he could see bodies lying in the alley. Three people were standing. They turned and looked into the lights of his Mercedes. He smiled and sighed with relief when he saw his American friends. Chapter 54. Stephanie Kovacs took a deep breath before she opened the door. She was on another, likely futile, job interview.
Pull it together, girl. Head up. Put on the big smile.
Maybe this time she'd have more luck. After all, she had known Carlton Morris for years. Kovacs grabbed a Newsweek magazine and sat down, waiting for her appointment.
5 turndowns this week. I don't have many more options left, she thought morosely.
She was halfway through an article on terrorism when the office door opened.
Stephanie Kovacs, how have you been? Morris called out.
With his bifocals perched on the tip of his nose, his untidy curly white hair and his broad smile, he looked like Santa Claus without the beard.
Thank you for seeing me, Carlton, Kovacs said soberly.
The typical chit-chat did not last long. Morris could see how upset Kovacs was.
Carlton, I need some help, she began. I'm out of a job right now, and I was wondering if you might have some openings here at Fox News.
Yeah, I heard you were no longer working for Barrington Communications. The grapevine.
He broke off, grinning ruefully, then looking sympathetically into Kovacs' eyes.
Stephanie, we've been friends for how many years?
About 13.
As your friend, I've got to be completely honest with you. The word is out on the street that Barrington's got it in for you. Last week, the president called me into his office and told me if you showed up looking for a job, I was to tell you that nothing was available. My hands are tied. I have to be honest, you've been blackballed. You won't be able to get any job in the East Coast or West Coast markets. You might find a weather reporting job in some small Midwest town, but I doubt it. Shane Barrington is out to ruin you. I'm so sorry.
Kovacs sat there silently for a moment. She had feared something like this would happen when she left Barrington, yet she had to try to find a job in the field that she loved, and in which she was good.
I know, Carlton. I don't hold it against you. It's just discouraging. The thought of changing careers in midstream isn't welcome.
I'm sorry, honey. I wish there was something I could do.
It had not been easy for Kovacs to go to sleep. She had tossed and turned, worrying about her future for hours. Finally, the escape of sleep had come. Suddenly, her eyes popped open, and she held her breath. All of her senses were alert.
What was that noise? How long have I been asleep?
She listened, taking only shallow breaths. All was quiet. She glanced over at her digital clock, 2:30 a.m. She thought she had heard a creak coming from the wooden floor in her living room, but then it was silent.
Is someone there? I locked the door and the windows. I must be having a bad dream.
She lay there for another 10 minutes, listening intently, but she heard nothing.
I've got to check or I'll never get to sleep.
Carefully and quietly, she sat up and slowly opened the drawer of the nightstand next to her bed. She reached in and pulled out a .32 automatic. Kovacs crept to her open bedroom door, leaned forward, and looked into the living room. It was empty and quiet. Carefully, she crossed the living room to the window that looked out on the city. She opened the blinds and peered out into the night. She could see a few lights in the apartment building across the avenue. There was no traffic down in the street.
Maybe a cup of hot chocolate would help me go back to sleep.
She entered the kitchen and looked around. There was nothing out of the ordinary.
You're just being foolish, she told herself.
Kovacs set the automatic down on the table and walked to the pantry. After a moment's hesitation, she returned to pick up the gun. Then she opened the door to the pantry. She wasn't quite sure what to expect. Would the pantry be empty, or would someone be standing there in the dark? As she swung the door open, a broom fell out. She almost fired the gun in surprise. Then she started laughing. She took the hot chocolate from the shelf, set the gun down on the counter, and started heating water. She then sat down at the table and thought, "What am I going to do about work?" She didn't hear a sound. All she felt was an iron grip of a glove-covered hand over her mouth and a forearm choking her. His head and mouth were pressing against her right ear.
"I wasn't in the living room or the kitchen, Stephanie,"
a man's voice taunted.
"I had already made it into your bedroom before you woke up. You walked right past me in the dark. Surprise."
Kovacs was terrified. "Who is this? What does he want?"
"I'll let go of you if you promise not to scream. If you do, it will be your last breath. Do you understand?"
Kovacs nodded her head. She didn't recognize the man's voice. It had no trace of emotion in it. Slowly, his grip relaxed. She was looking at her automatic on the counter.
"Can I distract him enough to get to the gun?"
"Turn around," the voice said.
Kovacs turned and faced a man with bone-white features, a neatly trimmed mustache, and blank eyes that made her shiver. He was thin, but there was no question that he was extremely strong.
"Who are you and what do you want?" she managed.
A thin smile broke across his lips.
"Very brave, aren't you? My name is Talon."
As he looked at her, he remembered the first time he had seen the feisty news reporter. It was on television. She had been reporting from Queens, New York, on the discovery of the home of the mastermind of a UN attack. Talon remembered chuckling as he watched her.
"This woman is good," he thought. "She may have more ice water in her veins than her boss Barrington has."
And now they were meeting face to face.
"You have been very brave in your news reporting, but not very smart. My employers think that you have been just a little too friendly with Dr. Michael Murphy. We've had your phone tapped for some time since you left Shane Barrington."
"What does Dr. Murphy have to do with all this?"
"You like to report the blunt facts in your commentaries. Let me give you the straight scoop. You have become a security leak for Mr. Barrington. We cannot tolerate your lack of loyalty. You have shared your last communication with Dr. Murphy."
Stephanie could tell she was in deep trouble.
"You see, Ms. Kovacs, it is no fun to stand behind people and choke them to death, unless perhaps you are standing in front of a mirror. The real pleasure comes from looking people in the eye as they die. That way you get to enjoy all the terror and pain that comes into their faces. It makes all the effort worthwhile."
Kovacs had been in many difficult situations as a news reporter, but nothing like this. She could tell that he was deadly serious. She knew that she had to get to the gun to have any chance at all. That would be the only way she would survive. Talon sensed her muscles tensing for motion. His hands surrounded her throat. He lifted her up to eye level and began to squeeze. Kovacs had no strength to try to fight back. He was squeezing the life out of her. Just as she felt herself drift toward unconsciousness, the grip on her neck loosened, and she started to cough. Then Talon grabbed her hair with his left hand and tilted her head back. At the same time, he used his teeth to pull the glove off his right hand. He readied his artificial finger with the razor tip. He would wait for Stephanie to open her eyes before he slit her throat.
"Mr. Barrington! Mr. Barrington, did you see the latest news flash?"
Melissa shouted, rushing into his office. Barrington didn't like to be interrupted when he was planning his morning schedule.
"What are you talking about, Melissa?"
he asked gruffly.
"Look, I'll turn on the news."
Melissa hurried to turn on the television.
"This is Mark Hadley reporting for BNN. I am standing outside of the apartment building of Stephanie Kovacs, a former investigative reporter for Barrington Communications and Network News. Apparently, she was murdered early this morning by an unknown assailant. We only have sketchy information at this time, but it looks like her throat was slit. Police investigators are questioning occupants of the apartment building. We will bring you an update on the 6 o'clock news. This is Mark Hadley bringing you this very sad report about one of our former BNN co-workers. Barrington stared at the television in shock. His secretary knew it would be best not to say anything. She quietly turned off the television and left the office. Barrington stared into space, totally confused. A wave of guilt flooded him. Then he began to think back to the good times he had had with Stephanie. He began to realize that he really did care for her, maybe even loved her. Sorrow engulfed him as he thought of their last meeting, of how he had beaten her and thrown the suitcases at her. He buried his face in his hands. He had destroyed her career in news reporting and left her with nothing. The realization that the only person he had ever cared about had been murdered infuriated him. What had the reporter said? Her throat was slit? It took a few minutes before he realized that this could have been the work of only one person, Talon. And he gets his orders from the Seven, Barrington thought grimly. A plan began to form in Barrington's mind. Chapter 55. Captain Drake arrived at the hotel early the next morning. He brought desert fatigues for everyone, along with bulletproof flak vests and helmets. While the team changed, he loaded all of their gear into a Hummer for the trip to Babylon. Murphy saw Isis in the lobby in her military clothes. She whirled around in front of him. "What do you think?" she asked, grinning.
"You make anything you wear look great."
Murphy felt a strong desire to take her in his arms and kiss her. He knew that he'd like to take their relationship to a deeper level, and he thought she did too. He was also aware that the only thing holding him back was their different spiritual outlooks. Isis looked at Murphy and smiled. "I didn't realize how tired and sore I was until the alarm went off this morning." Murphy nodded.
"I guess late-night battles and dark alleys do have a way of getting to you. I'm a little sore this morning, too. I couldn't believe how you fought back last night. I'm just glad that nothing more serious happened. I wouldn't want to lose you."
Isis looked at Murphy and smiled. It was the kind of smile that would melt any man. When the three Hummers pulled through the Green Zone security checkpoint, Murphy could see Jassim Amram standing on a corner next to his luggage.
"Captain Drake, that's the Egyptian friend I mentioned, Mr. Amram, the one wearing the white suit.
I brought a change of clothes and protective gear for him also. He can change when we catch up with the convoy going to Babylon. All of the vehicles will be following a buffalo."
"A water buffalo?" asked Isis. Captain Drake laughed.
"No, ma'am. I'm talking about an EOD.
EOD?
"Excuse me, ma'am. An explosive ordnance disposal vehicle. It's a special heavyweight armored vehicle that can withstand roadside bombs."
"Do you think we'll encounter a roadside bomb on the trip?" Isis couldn't keep the anxiety out of her voice.
"I certainly hope not. The Buffalo has been designed to go ahead of the troops and clear a safe path. Wait till you see it. It's about 25 feet long and stands almost 9 feet high. It's covered with armor plate on all sides and on the top. It also has extra thick steel on the bottom where a blast might occur. It rides on 6 Michelin run-flat tires. They can keep driving even with damaged tires."
"Don't the explosions endanger the driver?" Isis asked.
"Actually, there's more than just a driver. A buffalo can hold up to 10 soldiers. No one's been seriously injured yet. Because the vehicle is so high off the ground, the force of the explosion disperses to the sides. The front end sometimes lifts off the ground from the power of the explosion. Those riding inside say it's quite an experience to drive over IEDs, improvised explosive devices, and keep moving."
"I've heard about those vehicles," Murphy said. "Don't they have some kind of arm that can dig in the ground?"
"Yes, sir. It is called a spork. It's a remotely controlled hydraulic arm.
The arm ends in a pitchfork type of instrument that incorporates a video camera. The spork is controlled by a joystick that allows for precise and accurate control. Sometimes a pitchfork gets blown off during an explosion, but they can be repaired, usually within 48 to 72 hours.
At least men are not losing their lives.
Yes, sir. If you look up ahead, you can see the buffalo beginning to pull out and move ahead of the convoy. When we get to Babylon, I'll give you a tour of it.
Murphy looked over at Bingman, who seemed deep in thought.
What are you thinking about, Will?
I was thinking about Iraq and how much the Islam faith plays a part in politics and daily life of the people. What do you think?
I think faith does play a large part. It's been estimated that one in every five people in the world is a Muslim.
It's one of the fastest-growing religions on earth, Murphy explained.
Muslims are united on the Shahada, the profession of faith. They all believe there is no God but Allah and that Muhammad is his prophet. They are also united when they build their mosques, which all face east toward Mecca. After that, they aren't homogeneous. Their daily practice and philosophical beliefs vary in different parts of the world.
What about this talk of a jihad? What's that all about? Bingman asked.
Well, the Arabic meaning of the word is exerted effort. It means exerting effort to change oneself for the better. It can also mean physically standing against or fighting oppressors if necessary. It's the latter definition that has created quite a stir. It's not just fighting against an occupation army, it's fighting against what is perceived to be injustice and anything that might disagree with one's faith. Muhammad suggested to his followers, do not obey the kafirin, those who reject the truth, but wage jihad with the Quran against them. This is the concept that has many Westerners worried.
Does that mean if I don't believe what they do, they want me dead?
Some in the Muslim faith have suggested that. They see themselves in a holy war with non-believers. I've heard reports of many responding to the calls for jihad. For example, some men have left their homes and fought in Afghanistan, Iraq, and elsewhere.
Do all Muslims believe that way?
No, but extremists and terrorists have taken the term jihad and used it as a cry for all-out war against anyone who does not hold to their faith and beliefs. They've twisted the original Arabic meaning of fight only those who fight you to justify terrorism against innocent civilians and children. They've put a spin on the text and used it for their own personal agendas, Murphy concluded grimly.
That sounds scary. I wonder how many feel that way.
No one knows for sure. The problem is amplified whenever Muslim leaders do not speak out against terrorist activities. Their silence gives the impression that they may approve of them. This doesn't help their cause.
Yeah, that bothered me too. When I drive by one of their mosques, I wonder what they're doing in there. Are they planning the overthrow of the United States? Do they want to destroy my family?
Many Muslims do not believe that way at all, Will, Murphy explained. They love the United States and support it. But the average Westerner doesn't know this. They're not sure who they can trust. This lack of trust creates disharmony between groups. It causes the Muslims to draw away from non-Muslims and vice versa. It can have a devastating worldwide effect. It is a philosophical clash of societies and beliefs. This type of clash and distrust can foster war, just like what's happening right here in Iraq.
Their conversation was interrupted by a loud explosion, a ball of flame, and a pillar of black smoke. The Hummer stopped abruptly. The buffalo at the head of the convoy was bouncing up and down. Soldiers were piling out of their vehicles with their weapons ready. There was yelling, and vehicles were repositioned in case of a firefight. Captain Drake was the first to speak.
Well, that was a good example of what the buffalo can do. There must have been a bomb in the car up ahead.
He spoke as if it were a casual, everyday event. The buffalo backed out of the blazing inferno, stopped for a moment, then drove forward and lifted the car off the ground. It set the burning car to the side of the road, then continued on toward Babylon. Soldiers climbed back in their Hummers and the convoy continued.
It must take some special type of soldier to drive one of those buffaloes, Murphy said.
Yes, sir. Those are very special Marines. They love their jobs and look forward to each day's new adventure. The rest of us consider them heroes. They're risking their lives to save ours.
Chapter 56. One of the lions rolled over and dropped a paw onto Daniel's leg. He woke up instantly. It took a moment for him to gather his thoughts. He had almost forgotten he was in a den of lions. The weight of the paw on his leg brought him back to reality. Slowly and gently, he removed the paw and smiled. No one would believe this story. No one had ever been thrown to the lions and lived to tell the tale. He thought back to another time when he was startled awake. It was when the great city of Babylon fell to the armies of Azam and Jawar. He had arrived home and fallen into a restless sleep after interpreting the handwriting on the wall for Belshazzar. Suddenly, soldiers broke into his home carrying torches, their swords drawn. They rushed toward his bed as he sat up. The tip of one sword touched his chest. A soldier held a torch to his face. He made some comment, and the other soldier withdrew the sword. Then they searched the house and left as quickly as they had come. Daniel had no idea what they were looking for. Obviously, they thought he was too old to present any danger.
Kasim, did you taste the wine for the king this evening? Tamir asked.
No, he went to bed without any wine or food. He ordered everyone out, even the entertainers. He looked very ill.
Is the king sick?
No, I don't mean that type of ill look. He seemed both sad and angry at the same time. For a while I stayed outside of his door and listened. I could hear him moaning and groaning and talking to himself.
What's wrong?
I think he's angry over a decision to throw the old Hebrew into the lion's pit. He seemed very agitated. Watch it, Tamir. Don't make any mistakes in your baking. He might take it out on you.
At the sound of the large stone being removed from the hole in the ceiling, all the lions jumped up. Light glared down from the hole. Daniel put his hand up to shade his eyes. He could see the lions looking up, saliva dripping from their mouths. Was it time to be fed? Only their tails twitched back and forth. They didn't seem to pay any attention to him as he rose.
Oh, Daniel, servant of the living God, was your God, whom you worship continually, able to deliver you from the lions?
A voice called down from above. Daniel recognized the voice of Darius. He could tell from the king's tone that he did not expect an answer.
Your Majesty, life forever. My God has sent his angel to shut the lions' mouths. They did not touch me or harm me. It is proof of my innocence and faithfulness to you.
Daniel could hear the king dancing around and shouting for joy. Then the guards lowered a rope and pulled Daniel from the den. Just before he reached the opening, Daniel took one last look at the wild animals that had been gentle with him. He smiled and thanked God. Darius had his physicians examine Daniel for any injuries. None were found. Soon Darius's joy turned to anger. He was outraged that he had been tricked into putting Daniel in the den. Darius summoned the general of his army.
I want you to round up all of the satraps and governors Abu Bakr and Husam al-Din. Bring their wives and children with them. The lions are hungry and need to be fed. I want you to put in a new family every 3 days. Make sure that Abu Bakr and Husam al-Din are last. I want them to have time to think about their failed attempt to kill Daniel. Now, I want to make a decree to all of the people of the kingdom. It should read that everyone in the empire shall tremble and fear before the God of Daniel. He is the living, unchanging God, whose kingdom shall never be destroyed, and whose power shall never end. He delivers his people, preserving them from harm. He does great miracles in heaven and earth. It is he who delivered Daniel from the power of the lions. The first family did not touch the floor before the lions tore them apart.
Chapter 57.
It's kind of barren out here, Bingman said as they drove farther out of Baghdad.
You're right about that, Murphy responded. There are some grass and weeds and palm trees and a lot of open space. If it weren't for the Euphrates River running through Babylon, it would be more like a desert, more like the rest of the country.
They were silent as they watched the shepherds, a few roadside stands, and people moving in and out of small adobe homes near the river. Every now and then they could see fishermen in boats casting their nets.
What are those buildings up ahead? Bingman asked.
Well, that's Alhilla, Captain Drake replied. It's a small town right next to the site of the original Babylon. The Marines have set up a base there and send out daily patrols. We've also been instructed to guard and prevent any looting that might go on at local archaeological sites.
Murphy spoke up. I've heard that there's been massive looting of museums and archaeological relics. Many of them are being sold on the black market.
Yes, sir, that's true. It's a quick way for poor Iraqis to make some big money. We've done a good job at discouraging the theft, but occasionally they get away with something. Now we only allow those with archaeological permits, like yourselves, to get near any of the sites.
The town has certainly grown since we were last here, Murphy said, looking around.
Yes, sir. For some reason we've had a lot of dignitaries come and visit Babylon. A new hotel is being built, and businesses are moving in. I've even heard talk of investors coming into the area and buying up land.
Why do you think that is happening? Isis asked.
I don't know for sure, ma'am. I have heard there might be a possibility of the United Nations moving here, but I can't for the life of me see why. This is not the hottest attraction in Iraq, in my opinion.
Yet Babylon does have a long and glorious history, Isis said. It was the home of the great King Nebuchadnezzar and the Hanging Gardens of Babylon, one of the seven wonders of the world.
Yes, ma'am. And maybe it will have a glorious future if enough people get excited about it. In fact, there's a group of a dozen UN representatives in town now. We've been taking them all around. They've been looking at water supplies, building sites, and meeting with Iraqi businessmen and government leaders. It looks like they might be serious.
Bingman turned to Murphy and pointed.
What's that in the distance?
That's part of the ancient structures near where we'll be exploring. Look over to your left. You can see the buildings that Saddam was in the process of reconstructing. Some of the arches are 40 feet tall. Tomorrow you may get a chance to see the ancient roadway that leads to Babylon. It has a fence on either side to preserve the pavement, which dates back to 400 BC.
Michael, when you were here last, did you have a chance to explore the ruins? Bingman asked eagerly.
A little, Murphy replied. Most of our efforts were directed at finding Nebuchadnezzar's golden head.
Did you see any of the bricks that had Nebuchadnezzar's name on them? I've read that he had his name on most of the exposed brick surfaces.
Yes, I did see his name on many of the bricks. But listen to this. Saddam had his name put on the new bricks that were added to the original foundation. He wanted to get the credit for rebuilding Babylon.
Will Colonel Davis be on hand to meet us? Amram asked the captain.
No, sir. He's out on a mission and won't arrive back until late this evening. He'll meet you in the morning. Is there something I can help you with?
I was just wondering if he received my message about borrowing the sonar sled. We used it when we were here last time to find the hollow opening into the chamber where the golden head was found.
I believe he did, sir. I know that I saw our men checking it out before I went to Baghdad to pick you up.
That's good news, Captain. That will save us a lot of unnecessary digging.
Chapter 58. Isis was looking forward to an exciting day. She was eager to get started in the hunt for the handwriting on the wall.
She was halfway through the mess line for breakfast when she had the eerie feeling that she was being watched. Murphy smiled as he noticed her discomfort.
"Is there something wrong?" he asked, grinning.
"I feel like I'm being stared at."
"Of course you are. Turn around."
About 200 Marines were looking in her direction. They smiled in unison when they noticed her looking into the room. It took her a moment to gain composure. She then smiled, waved, and turned around, grabbing her tray. After getting their food, they turned and looked for a place to sit. Immediately, 6 Marines jumped to their feet, grabbed their trays, and stepped back, waving their arms for them to sit down. Isis flushed but acknowledged their compliment and sat down with the team.
"That's embarrassing," she said.
The men laughed. Murphy, Isis, Bingman, and Amram were deep in conversation about the expedition when all of a sudden the Marines jumped up. A deep voice shouted,
"Attention! At ease, men. Continue eating."
They turned to see the tanned, rugged face of Colonel Davis. Beneath his aviator shades, his steel-blue eyes were sparkling and alert. The muscles on his forearm rippled as he shook hands with everyone, his grip like steel. He was the type of soldier you'd want on your side in a battle.
"Welcome to Babylon," Davis said. "I'm happy to see that you all arrived safely. I have your sonar sled ready, and I've assigned Captain Drake to assist you. He has a platoon of men at your disposal. Please do not hesitate to call on them for any assistance. They'll instantly respond. These are some of the best Marines in Iraq."
Murphy was drawn to the colonel's command presence. He could tell that Davis's men would follow wherever he led.
"Thank you, sir. We appreciate all that you're doing to make our expedition a success. When we were here last time, you assisted us with a bulldozer. Would that be available this time?" Murphy asked.
"By all means, except we'll have to be very careful as we use it. We have strict orders not to damage any ancient artifacts. I'm sorry that I won't be able to be with you today. I'm scheduled for some meetings with a group from the United Nations."
"Of course," Murphy said. "Thank you again for all of your help, Colonel."
If Methuselah's directions are accurate, it shouldn't be too difficult to find the handwriting on the wall, Murphy said, reaching into his pocket and pulling out the 3x5 card that Methuselah had left for him. He read aloud to the group, which now included Marines with shovels who were waiting for orders.
"Babylon, 375 meters directly northeast of the head."
Jassim Amram was looking around for the site where they found Nebuchadnezzar's golden head.
"It looks like it's been covered over since we were last here. I think it is in this general area. We'll have to use the sonar sled to find the spot."
Captain Drake had the men sweep the area. It took almost 2 hours before they found the spot.
"Michael, I will use my compass and pace off 375 meters toward the northeast. Look over there," Amram said, pointing. "I'll bet it is very close to those old ruins."
"Captain Drake, if you and your men could follow Mr. Amram, I think he'll need some help," Murphy said.
After several hours of looking, a spot was located and the sonar sled was turned on. The Marines dragged the sled back and forth until it registered a void in the ground. They then dragged the sled in a crisscross fashion to pinpoint the void.
"Dr. Murphy, I think we can use the bulldozer to remove some of this sand. We won't drive over the void in case it collapses on us. We'll just drag the sand away."
"Fine, Captain. I think that's the safest way to operate."
The sonar sled estimated the depth of the sand to the point of the void at about 18 inches. Marines with shovels were brought in to do the more careful digging. Soon a sound of metal scraping on rock could be heard. Another 15 minutes of digging exposed the top of a square capstone with a large metal ring on each corner. Bingman stepped forward.
"I'll bet they put poles through the rings and sets of men lifted it into place," he exclaimed. "It's got to be the covering of some type of chamber."
Murphy called for the backhoe, and chains were attached to the four rings.
This will be a little easier than having teams of men trying to lift it, he explained, smiling. Soon the backhoe was lifting the stone. There was a slight hiss, then a musty smell escaped from the opening. Murphy and the team brought their flashlights and shined them down.
Look, Isis exclaimed, a set of stairs. I'll bet that this was a back entrance. It's not